Okay, let's start in. So we're going to start a little bit with stuff we've been talking about, opening Dewar benzene that I didn't get to last time. Then we're going to make a shift in gears and go to stuff about spectroscopy, and then come back to talk a little bit more about aromatic compounds and continue. Today I hope to talk about electronic spectroscopy and infrared, and then next time we'll get to nuclear magnetic resonance. So we remember Dewar benzene from last semester, this two four-membered rings with double bonds in them sharing a common bond in the middle. But the question is, if you ever made that, would it go just to benzene or would it be stable? Because all you'd have to do is break that bond in the middle and you'd have six bonds around the periphery, each with a single hydrogen, and you'd get to benzene with all this 30 kilocalories of resonance stabilization. Now there are a number of isomers of C6H6. In fact, in 2004, someone set out to calculate the energies of all these different isomers of C6H6, the most stable of which naturally is benzene up here. They found that 84 of them were calculated to be within 100 kilocalories per mole of benzene, that is within about one bond of benzene. And six of them that are greater than 100 kilocalories per mole above benzene have in fact been prepared. Right? Now, why don't they isomerize to benzene? It's because in most cases, like this one up here, for example, if you broke a bond, you don't get something more stable, right? You just get two radicals, okay? Or this one here, have you ever seen that one before? That's Ladenburg's benzene. It, in fact, was prepared in the late 50s or early 60s, right? And here are four others. But one here is particularly interesting, this one over here. This is Dewar's benzene, which was prepared in 1963. And it's 74 kilocalories higher than benzene, but still it lasts 2 days at room temperature, right? That's remarkable, because all you'd have to do is, as I said, is break this central bond, fold these two hydrogens out, and you have benzene, right? Now, we could also consider this to be, localize our interest in this four-membered ring with a double bond, cyclobutene, which we see here with the double bond. And it also can open, and we talked about this, to butadiene. Right? Now, that reaction is only 11 kilocalories exothermic. This is only 11 kilocalories more stable than what's caused by the ring strain here. Okay? But in the case of Dewar benzene and benzene, the starting material is much more strained because there are two cyclobutanes sharing a side, and the product is very much more stable. Right? So this one is 75 kilocalories exothermic. So you would expect the activation energy to be very much lower if you do the Hammond postulate kind of thing. Indeed, it is lower. The activation energy for cyclobutene opening to butadiene is 33. The activation energy for Dewar benzene becoming benzene is 25. But it's 66 kilocalories more exothermic and only 8 kilocalories per mole lower in activation energy. That's a pretty piddling percentage of 66 kilocalories per mole. You might expect something more like half of that, right, which would make it very, very fast. But as I say, it lasts for 2 days at room temperature. So why is it so slow? Why is Dewar benzene so slow to open that central bond and go directly to very stable benzene? Well, remember in opening cyclobutene, it's important that this motion be conrotatory, that in breaking the sigma bond here, one part go up and the other go down, right? And that's good for 4n electrons rather than 4n plus 2. Okay? So, and we can see it here. Here's the sigma bond breaking, the blue things coming apart. But as they rotate in the same direction, they overlap favorably with pi star. So the HOMO in front overlaps the LUMO in back, and that's good, of course. At the same time, the HOMO in back overlaps the LUMO in front and gets stabilized. So both interactions are stabilizing, right? And this is what we expect con-rotatory, and it's good because there are 4n electrons involved in these four p orbitals. How about in Dewar benzene? Can it do the same thing? Well, it can't do the same thing because it has to be disrotatory. This hydrogen has to rotate one way while this one rotates the other. Can you see why? Why is it that these hydrogens both have to open out? You can't have one in and one out so that they're con-rotatory. Right? If you bent this hydrogen in, this angle would be develop a trans double bond here. Does everybody see that? This hydrogen would be trans to that hydrogen if it rotated in. Right? And so with this, the hydrogen would also, if it rotated in, be trans to that hydrogen. So you'd have two trans double bonds in a six-membered ring, which is just inconceivable. The bond angles would be way, way too strained. This carbon-carbon-carbon angle would be really, really sharp. Okay, so the CCC angles require that the motion be disrotatory, whereas here for opening cyclobutene, it was con-rotatory. But that should be okay, shouldn't it? Because with six carbons in the ring, we're going to have six electrons. That's 4n plus 2. So 4n plus 2 is Huckel aromatic. You'd think the transition state when you're beginning to get this overlap should be stabilized, right? Because it has 6p electrons, all their orbitals touching on top. But if you look at what actually happens, when you break the sigma bond here and make it, and the sigma star LUMO begins to overlap with the pi's, notice that this overlap is unfavorable, right? That is to say, they're not unfavorable, it's just neither. It's sigma star is orthogonal to this pi orbital. Also, it's orthogonal to this pi orbital. So the fact that it's 6p orbitals in a ring all overlapping is not as important as the fact that sigma star doesn't overlap pi, nor does the sigma bond here, which is blue-blue, overlap pi stars, which are blue-red. Right? So you don't get any electrons stabilized in the transition state, even though a slavish application of the 4n plus 2 rule, saying that you have six electrons in a ring with all their top of the orbitals all touching, say that would be good. But that's not the main thing. The main thing is that HOMOs and LUMOs interact with one another to achieve electron stabilization. Is this clear to folks? Okay, so you have to be careful about this 4n plus 2 rule. Almost always it's true that when you have 6 pi electrons and all the orbitals are touching, so you have Huckel connectivity rather than Möbius where it's twisted. Usually that's great, but here's a particular case where it's not true. Okay, so that's the lesson from the remarkable stability of Dewar benzene. That it's HOMO-LUMO mixing that you get in the transition state that's the dominant feature. Okay, now we're going to switch gears and go into spectroscopy. Now, it's spectroscopy for two purposes, identifying the structure of molecules and telling things about why the structure is the way it is, and also for understanding the dynamics of how molecules behave, not just the structures, but how fast they move in different ways, how fast they react. Of course, you've used spectroscopy in lab, IR spectroscopy. Have you done any NMR spectroscopy? I don't remember.
We This week
you're going to be doing. So we're right on time for that, for a surprise. But IR have you used? But the main way I bet you've used it is either as a fingerprint to say this one does looks like the authentic sample, or to say that there's this particular functional group there. Have you done that too? Okay. So, but we want to understand a little bit about why functional groups come in certain positions. What makes peaks strong? Okay, and what gives rise to fingerprints? So we're going to understand a little more about how IR spectroscopy works. And then the stuff about dynamics I think you'll find particularly interesting when we get to that. So there are three styles of spectroscopy we're going to talk about. Electronic spectroscopy, which is in the visible and UV part of the spectrum, which involves taking electrons in a HOMO and putting them into a LUMO. And that's covered a little bit in the book in these, I forgot to put the second, it's 533 to something or other, anyhow, sections 12.7 to 12.8. And vibrational spectroscopy, that's infrared, and then we'll get to NMR, which uses radio frequencies. Okay? The word spectrum, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, had its roots in 1605 when people talked about specters or strange sights, visions or apparitions. But the first use of the word spectrum, according to the OED, was actually by Isaac Newton. And it had to do with the experiment we talked about. Remember where he put light through a prism and split it into a spectrum? So that evidently is the first use of the word spectrum. But now spectra appear everywhere in all ranges of the electromagnetic spectrum. And in fact, it's even used to talk about things that aren't spectra at all, like mass spectroscopy, which we aren't going to have time to talk about, which has to do really with just weighing fragments of molecules in the gas phase. Okay, now, last semester we used atom in a box, and we mentioned in passing that it could be used to show the transitions for these hydrogen-like atoms. That is, what the energy levels are and what wavelength of light it would take to go from an occupied orbital to a vacant orbital in these one-electron atoms. Furthermore, we looked at how you can shift electron density by mixing orbitals together, by hybridizing. Remember, why did we mix 2s with 2p? Or why did we mix s with p? What was that a response to? Why would you think that that might be a good, a better orbital than either s alone or p alone? Remember what it did? Yeah, Mike? Right, it would shift it one way. Remember where p has opposite signs on the two sides? On the two sides of the atom. S is the same everywhere. If you add them, it'll shift one direction. Okay, so we saw that you could shift electron density by mixing. And it's especially good if the two have the same energy, because if they have different energy, then it's hard to mix them. You make the orbital worse in energy by mixing 2p into 1s. Okay. And we also talked about or you can show with this, and I think I showed it at the time, but oscillation of electron density if you mix orbitals with different energy. And it's because the phase changes in time, and I'll show you that. That is, if you had the 2p orbital here and the 2s, and you add them, they'll get big on this side. If you subtract them, they get big on this side. So if you change the 2p orbital from being plus minus to being minus plus, then the electrons will shift back and forth. They'll wash back and forth. Okay? And that actually happens when you mix those two orbitals. And this is a feature of time-dependent quantum mechanics, where the phase of the wave function... Remember we said at the time we were doing quantum mechanics that the wave functions could even be complex. The main point where you get complex wave functions is when you begin to talk about time. And I'll say just a word about that on the next slide. So you get oscillating dipoles from mixing 1s with 2p. That, if you move electrons back and forth, that's the way an antenna works to generate waves, radio waves, right? At the same time, if you have an antenna here and radio waves come in, they cause electrons in the antenna to slosh back and forth. So the antenna both can generate and receive radio waves. It's the coupling between electrons and radiation. right, is this moving back and forth of electrons. Okay? On the other hand, if you moved electrons not back and forth, but in and out like this, sort of a breathing, right, then you don't generate an electric field, right, like as you do when you move things back and forth, and that won't interact with light. So this is an important thing. Which kinds of motions of electrons interact with light, and which kinds do not interact with light, neither generating light nor absorbing light? And so here's a picture of it. There's a 1s on the top left and 2p on the top right. And if you put that into atom in a box and look at the electron density of the superposition of these two, you can see here that when I've added the two, they've reinforced on top and canceled on the bottom. But if I look at the time dependent, as you can do with atom in a box, it looks like this. The electrons slash back and forth as you change the phase of 2p relative to 1s. Okay, now here's just a footnote, and I don't expect you to dig into this, but some of you want to know how things work, and this is how it works. So a time-dependent wave function looks just like the spatial wave functions we've looked at, where the wave function is a function of what? What's wave function a function of? Position, x, y, z, right? That's the spatial wave function, and that's fine. But if you're interested in time variation, time dependence, then you put in another thing that has to do with t. And what you do is multiply the normal wave function you have, psi, by e to the I omega t, a weird looking thing, right? It involves an exponent that's imaginary, where I is the square root of minus 1, omega is the energy of the state. So the time dependence will be different depending on how energetic the orbital you're talking about is. And you express it in frequency units, and then the spatial wave function you put in, of course, and t is the time. So does anybody remember what e to the ix is equal to? E to the ix, yeah. Victor? It's cos x plus I sine x, right? Okay, so that means if x is omega t, as time increases, the angle that it's the sine of will change, and it'll go back and forth from positive to negative to positive to negative. So that says that you're going to be multiplying this spatial function, the thing you normally talk about, like the 2p orbital. You're going to be multiplying it by something that's going to change back and forth from positive to negative, right? So if we then add that to an s orbital, it's going to cause the electrons to move up and then down and then up and then down. Now, what this looks weird to begin with, because we express how fast it goes back and forth, how dependent it is on time, depends on how big omega is. If you make omega twice as big, it becomes twice as sensitive to time. And then you have to wonder, what do I take for zero of energy? See? Because if I take different zeros for energy, to talk about the energy of the molecule, like particles all separated, or particles in the hydrogen atom, or something like that, I could take anything as zero. Right? But if I have different zeros, this says that the dependence on time is different depending on what I take zero to be. That turns out, in fact, not to be a problem, because we're only interested in relative phases. When you put two things together, right? If you change the sign of this one, you make the electrons slosh back and forth. If you change the sign of this one, the electrons would slosh back and forth. If you change both of them, it wouldn't do anything. The square is going to come out the same as it was before. Right? So it's only the relative phases of the two things that make a difference. So you only care about the relative energy of the two functions you're mixing together. Okay, so that turns out not to be a problem, what zero of omega is. So in many cases, as I say, it makes no difference, because when you square the wave function, you do it for imaginary things like this by multiplying by the complex conjugate. So this part disappears. You subtract you add the exponents to multiply them, and that disappears, and you get psi squared, which is what we've always dealt with, and we're very happy. Okay? But there's a problem. when you're actually mixing two states of different energy. So if this energy is different from this energy, if the 2s is different from the 2p, right? Then these things won't cancel when you multiply them, right? And now, so if you have this and omega 1 is not the same as omega 2, if they're different, then they'll get in and out of phase with one another. If at a certain time they add, at a time that's that difference in frequency later, they will subtract. For example, 1s plus 2pz will become 1s minus 2pz, and the electrons will slosh from the top to the bottom. So that's the way this time dependence works. And again, this isn't a course in physical chemistry or math, so don't spend a lot of time on this, but I just thought you'd like to know what time dependence means. So this is the source of the oscillation we observe when we superimpose functions of different n using atoms in a box. Now, I put a footnote here to the footnote. I say when you're actually mixing two states, of course we've talked about hybridizing things before, but not for this purpose. We weren't actually mixing two orbitals of different energy. What we were doing was saying we want to get the proper shape for an orbital of a given energy, so we'll take some of this shape and some of this shape and sort of mix them together to approximate the kind of shape we want to get that'll make the energy minimum. But the electron that has that energy, right, has exactly that energy, right? Not some of the time one energy and some of the time the other energy. It has some intermediate energy from that kind of mixing. But this is a different one. What happens when you absorb light is you start with a function of one energy and you change it to a function of a different energy. And now you have time dependence that comes in and how fast the electron will move back and forth as it interacts with light. So that's a different kettle of fish from what we've done before. So this is what time dependence does, and we're not going to spend time with time dependence, but just remind you that this is what happens. It makes this stuff oscillate up and down. When light comes along, it mixes 1s with 2p because the electrons slosh back and forth. Or if you have 2p, the electrons can slosh back and forth, mixing with 1s and give off light. Okay, so it generates or absorbs light, and this then is said to be an allowed transition. That is, this type of motion of the electrons generates or absorbs light. Now contrast that with what you'd get if you were mixing 1s and 2s, and here's the sum of those two. Now what would happen to this if we change the sign? This says that it reinforces in the middle when we add these two, and reinforces out here, right where it's blue and blue, and cancels in the middle. Now why did I put plus there? I don't remember. Okay. But if we do it time dependent and do it back and forth, it sloshes in and out rather than back and forth. See how that happens when we change the sign? So the electrons move like, and that doesn't make light, and it doesn't absorb light. So the transition from 1s to 2s is said to be forbidden. Right, so some electronic transitions are allowed because they make electrons move back and forth when you mix the two states, and some are forbidden because they don't make them go back and forth. Okay, now let's go from an atom to a molecule. Suppose we have some molecule that has a C double bond X, and I want X to have an unshared pair of electrons. It could, for example, be an oxygen or a nitrogen. So the sigma electron's here, and of course there's a pi LUMO here. So would these electrons mix with this LUMO? No, they're orthogonal. What would happen if you did take the sum of those two, of this orbital and this orbital? Well, if this orbital is plus here, we'd get plus plus here and plus minus here. So it would wag up, right? If we took n plus pi star, we'd get that the electrons would move up. By the same token, if we took n minus pi star, it would move down, right? So if n and pi star have different energies and light comes along, right? It can mix those two and make the electrons oscillate up and down. Right? So it could go like this. Right? Now, there's a large energy gap between N and pi star. So this transition occurs at very high frequency. Right? So the light that's going to be generated if those electrons move back and forth, or that's going to be absorbed to make them move back and forth, is going to be high, very high frequency in the ultraviolet. Right? Can you see how you might be able to make this a visible absorption? You'd have to make the energies of the orbitals much more similar to one another. Right? Now, the unshared pair on X, I suppose you could change X, right? But an easier thing to do is to change the LUMO. How do you change the LUMO? Why did I draw a long line here? Why? Not another lone pair. Put more P orbitals out. Make a longer and longer conjugated chain. Remember with the semicircle? You put all those, you put a certain number of lines between the top and the bottom, and the more you put in, the closer the HOMO and the LUMO come to one another. Right? So by making a longer and longer conjugated chain, you can make the LUMO drop in energy until this transition that's involved here, this optical transition, the light that's involved, comes into the visible range. So for example, if you made this the LUMO, incidentally, can you see why I drew this as the LUMO? Plus, minus, minus, plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, plus, minus, minus. It's because the very highest, what's the very lowest orbital look like? Pi orbital. Hilo, what do you say? The very lowest energy one. All plus. What would the very highest one look like? Yeah, plus, minus, plus, minus. So the one that's halfway in between is plus, minus, minus, plus, plus, minus, minus. That's half as many nodes. Got the idea? So this is going to be the LUMO. Now it'll be much closer in energy to this. So now the light that's involved, the difference in frequency, the difference in energy of the two will be much smaller, and it can get into the visible range. So pi star, the pi star mix approaches energy of the 2p orbital. And now here's a case like that, where you have a bunch of double bonds in a row, right? And finally at the end, a nitrogen with an unshared pair on it. Right, and this is the retinaldehyde imine of rhodopsin. That's what absorbs light in your eye. Okay, so it's exactly that. And notice it's cis here. When it absorbs light, it's able to rotate and become trans, because you occupy an orbital that's antibonding instead of bonding there. So now it can rotate, and that triggers the response of your nervous system to the absorption of light by that particular what's called a chromophore, something that gives light to, that gives interaction with light. Okay, now I couldn't resist putting this in. This is from a paper in the Swiss Chemical Journal in 1952. And what it says is, during work on the synthesis of vitamin A, which was being done at Hoffmann-La Roche, which is in Basel, a pharmaceutical term, this is in the scientific laboratories there of Hoffmann-La Roche, during work on the synthesis of vitamin A, a palladium lead catalyst was developed with which one can hydrogenate a triple bond without attacking double bonds already present in the starting material or those created by the hydrogenation. You ever hear of anything like that? Was it on the exam? What do you call the catalyst? Lindlar catalyst. That's the guy, the Swiss chemist who figured this out. And an example he gives in this paper is in the synthesis of beta carotene, right? So that's what rabbits eat to make their eyes sharp and so on, right? So it's got a long, long conjugated chain here. So they were trying to synthesize this, or Inhofen and his co-workers were doing it, by partial hydrogenation of a triple bond. So here's a triple bond that they were able to make. So this was called carotene ine, right, with a triple bond. And they used catalytic hydrogenation to make that into a double bond, but it didn't hydrogenate anything else. Okay, so that's why this catalyst was so neat. Okay, and he said here the carotene I and 3, it was used in a mixture of hexane and benzene, and at room temperature it was hydrogenated. The hydrogenation product 4, this thing with now a double bond here, stays in solution. The hydrogen is added how? How is it added? It's added cis. Right? Okay. Which gives 99 cis beta carotene. But with light and heat, it can be quantitatively converted into what? All trans. It's interesting they use the English word all. Right? So it becomes all trans beta carotene. So it's the same thing as in the eye, right? You have this cis one that absorbs light. You get an antibonding interaction there and the thing can rotate. Okay, I just thought that was an interesting thing to add. Incidentally, one more footnote to the past here. Notice that the formula of carotene is C40, H56. Does that make you think? Does that ring any bells? That it's C40? Victor, what do you say? It's a tetraterpene, 4 times C10. So here are those C5 units that you can see in the skeleton. So it started out as isopentenyl pyrophosphate and linked together and so on. So I just thought it was worth underlining that again. So anyhow, here's retinal, the stuff that's in your, that is, nitrogen goes on there to make it the stuff in your eye when it's a cis double bond there. Okay, and I don't know why, for some reason this takes a long time to load this next picture. Okay, so there's, you can see it's closely related to beta carotene, which is sort of a dimer of it. And here's the scarlet tanager in the fall. You would wonder why they call it scarlet. Right, the stuff that gives it a green or yellow color is this stuff, which is very like carotene, except it has an OH group here and an OH group here. This one turns out to be yellow, right? And notice that the unshared pair on the oxygen is here. There is no p orbital vacant here. That's a CH. Right? So it's not conjugated. The unshared pair is not conjugated with all this stuff of carotene. So this stuff called isozeaxanthin is the stuff that makes the scarlet tanager yellow. But here's a scarlet tanager in the spring. It looks sort of scuzzy because it's a mixture of greenish-yellow and reddish. But in the summer, it looks like that. And now you can see why it's the scarlet tanager. And what happens chemically is, look here. That gets oxidized to a ketone, both here and here. And now the O is conjugated with that, and you can get these unshared pairs mixing with the pi star system with a low LUMO, and you get much longer wavelength interaction, and it becomes scarlet. Yeah.
What oxidizes it?
Oh, it's a, I don't actually know what oxidizes it in the feathers. Yeah, but it's undoubtedly some biological oxidizing agent, but I don't know what it is. I mean, it's not just oxygen. It's under control. You can see the tanager control it, so it happens in the spring, right, as it gets into breeding season. Okay, now back to the subject of spectroscopy. Now, spectra usually are graphs, or usually presented as graphs. Okay, so we have, when you see a graph, you wonder what the axes are. At least that's what you're supposed to worry about, right? So there are the two axes, right? Now, what's the meaning of the axes? There are three different ways to interpret the axes, right? According to different ways of thinking about spectroscopy. From a purely empirical point of view, you have color along here, different wavelength of light, different color. And up here, what's plotted vertically? Can you tell me? How strongly it interacts with the light, how much it absorbs the light. This one is, it does it by how much light gets through the sample, how much didn't get absorbed, right? So that's light intensity. So from an empirical point of view, it's a plot of color and light intensity. Now, in order to understand it, we could look at the quantum mechanical point of view, in which case the horizontal axis is the molecular energy gap. Remember, that was what this frequency was, the time-dependent quantum mechanics was how fast they went back and forth. Or it could be differences in vibrational energy levels that we talked about last semester. Okay, so this is the energy gap that corresponds to color. And vertically is how much overlap you get, how much mixing of these two things that are a certain energy apart you get with the light. As we saw, sometimes light is able to interact and cause the gap to be bridged. For example, 1s going to 2p. Other times it's not able to, like 1s to 2s, which is the breathing instead of the sloshing back and forth of the electrons. So how much light of a given color gets absorbed depends not only that there be that energy difference exists in the molecule, but also that the light be able to interact with it. It'll interact much more strongly with some than with others. Okay, so that's the quantum mechanical point of view. And then there's a classical mechanical point of view, where this is a molecular vibrational frequency. That's easily thought of in IR, for example, the rate at which some bond stretches that has to do with the strength of the bond and the weight of the mass of the atoms, right? So, and the vertical one is how good light's handle is, how much this vibration, whatever it is that's happening at this given frequency along the red axis, how strongly that interacts with light. If you're shifting electrons, creating a dipole, then that'll interact with light, either to absorb or give off. So these three different ways of thinking about the graph of a spectrum are useful. And notice it's molecular vibration frequency. So this gets us into IR. So infrared spectroscopy uses light to fingerprint molecules, but also to identify their functional groups, and as we'll see, to study their dynamics. So to understand bonding and whether atoms are truly linked by something that looks like springs. Okay. Now, vibration is sinusoidal, up and down. Okay. Why? What does it tell you that it's sinusoidal in time? Okay. So the displacement. Again, this slide is mathematical a little bit. I mean, it's not very challenging, but it's not the main point of the course. But I wanted to show you, make a point here. Okay, so the displacement, say, up and down in X, has to do with the sine of omega t. That means it's sinusoidal in time. Okay, which, and omega is the frequency. And H, then, is the half amplitude, because it can go, the sine can go to plus 1, minus 1. So it goes twice that far up and down. Okay, so H is the half amplitude. So then if you take the derivative, what the velocity is, you get H omega cosine omega t. And the second derivative, the acceleration, has back to sine omega t. So if you look at the acceleration and divide it by X, if you take this, the acceleration, and divide by X, acceleration over X, the sines cancel out and the H's cancel out and you get minus omega squared. Right? Now, this means that the system's obeying Newton's laws. A equals F over M. Right? The acceleration is the force over the mass, or mass times the acceleration is the force. And Hooke's law. The force is equal to minus how much it's stretched. The Hooke's law constant, right? Because if you plug these two together, substitute for F there, right? Then you see that A over X is minus F over M, right? And that, as we see up here, A over X is minus omega squared, right? So to get this, so omega squared is equal to the force constant, Hooke's law, divided by the mass. So if you get this kind of dependence, it turns out to mean that you're obeying Hooke's law, that the thing is behaving like a spring. And when you have that, it says the frequency is equal to the square root of how strong the spring is divided by how big the mass is that's moving. Right? So if you, and that means that it doesn't depend on what the amplitude is, right? You can be vibrating this far or vibrating up and down this far. It's still the same frequency. So if you have a fixed frequency for the vibration of something, that means it's obeying Hooke's law, right? Do bonds really obey Hooke's law? No, it's more like a Morse potential, remember? At the bottom, it looks pretty much like Hooke's law. So you look at the spacing of the energy levels. If it were Hooke's law, all the spacings would be the same. All the frequencies would be the same, to go from 1 to 2 to 3, 3 to 4, 4 to 5. But if it doesn't quite obey Hooke's law, right, then it won't be really a constant frequency. There'll be a little difference. And that, in fact, is true. They're not perfectly like springs, but they're rather like springs. Okay. Now, why did Hooke care about this? Because he wanted to devise a watch that would have a constant frequency, right, that could tell you where you were east and west in navigation, right? So that the vibrations would be of equal duration, whether they be greater or less. Okay? So when Hooke's law applies, the frequency is proportional to the square root of the force, how strong the spring is, divided by the mass. Now, F then would be the bond stiffness. You could have a single bond, you could have a double bond, you could have a triple bond. Okay? And M is the mass that's moving. Now, if you have a if you have an atom attached by a bond to a concrete block that can't move, right? Then it's obvious what the mass is. But if you have two hydrogens hooked together, they're both going to be moving. And then you wonder, what do I use for the mass if there are two things moving? We're not going to go into this. But you use a thing called mu, the reduced mass, the product of the masses divided by their sum. Now notice, if one of them was a concrete block, enormous, and the other was very small, that mu, the thing you plug in here, if two atoms are moving, is dominated by the smaller mass. Suppose M is ever so big, then the denominator is within a very small error, the same as M, right? Plus or minus, or it's only bigger by a very small fraction of a percent, right? So you can cancel the denominator and the M and the numerator, and then it's just the light mass. So the light mass is the one you care about usually. So now, what's going to give really high frequencies? That's why we're thinking about this. Well, if this controls the frequency, what two factors would give you a high frequency? What's one factor that would give you a high frequency, Sonny?
Smaller mass.
Yeah, small mass or
a bigger.
So if you go to a triple bond, you'll get a higher frequency than if you use a single bond, right? Now, how much over what range can you change F? You can have a single bond, a double bond, a triple bond, maybe a little bit of subtlety in there according to resonance and stuff. But anyhow, it varies roughly from 1 to 3. How about the denominator? How much can you vary M? You can vary from 1 for hydrogen up to 237 for uranium or higher, right? So you have much more flexibility in M than in F. So what's going to give the very highest stretching frequencies in your IR spectrum? What kind of bond will give the very highest? Ryan? How can you make this as big as you can?
You want something with a bond and a pretty low mass, maybe like...
Well, which is more important?
Mass.
The mass is more important.
Yeah.
Right, so the best would be a triple bond and a really low mass. Where do you get a really low mass?
Hydrogen.
Right, but you can't get a triple bond. But still, hydrogen is so much lighter than everything else that it's better to have a single bond with hydrogen than anything else with a triple bond. So the far left of the spectrum, the high frequency, is going to be XH stretching. Right, but there'll be different bonds, of course, you know, different things attached to the H, oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, and so on. And it'll depend on how strong the bond is. Then not all single bonds are equal. Okay? So, notice incidentally that the mu for a hydrogen carbon bond, 1 times 12 over 12, is practically 1, the same as hydrogen. But for a carbon carbon bond, it's only half as big as carbon, it's 6. Okay. And for CO, it's 6.9. CCl, it's 8.9. It's approaching the mass of carbon, 12, if you made this other atom really, really heavy. Okay, so mu HX stands apart. That's what we were just talking about. It's so different from everything else. 1 versus greater than 6. Okay, so for CH, the frequency is proportional to the square root of a single bond, 1 over 0.9, right? And that turns out to be at about 3,000 wave numbers, or 10 to the 14th oscillations a second, hertz. Okay? CO would be the square root, again, of a single bond, but divided by 6.9. Right? And that turns out to be 3 times 10 to the 13th, about 1,100 wave numbers. And where have we seen that before, 10 to the 13th? Where have we seen 10 to the 13th per second before? Right, that's how fast the transition state moves. Remember? That's where that general thing comes from, that general idea that things are going to be moving about that fast. So it's about how fast medium weight atoms, first row atoms, move. Okay, if it's a double bond, we're going to have 2 over 6.9 because we got a double bond. So that's going to be about 1,500 wave numbers. And a triple bond will be square root of 3 over 6.5 for CN. Okay, so that's about 1,900 wave numbers. So this then tells you what's coming in what region of the spectrum qualitatively. There'll be little differences in how strong the bonds are. For example, hybridization will make a difference. Okay. But when organic chemists wanted to use IR spectroscopy, the physical chemists told them they were out of their depth. And the reason was because the oscillators are coupled. So I'm just going to show you this now, and we'll talk about the slides that have to do with it next time. The problem is this. We're going to use that thing to illustrate the idea of coupled oscillators, which will illustrate the complexity of IR spectra, the idea of normal mode analysis, and the phase of mixing, and the possibility that things will be simpler than the physical chemists were telling us they would be. So let's see what's involved. Here are oscillators. Okay, so here's a spring and a weight on the end, and it vibrates at a given rate. And this one also vibrates at a given rate. In fact, they vibrate at the same rate. Okay, but they're independent of one another. Okay, but here I have a weak spring. And if I raise that up, then it'll stretch and shrink as these things vibrate. Right? So now they're no longer independent of one another. Right? So I can vibrate this one. And notice it now has a little more resistance to its vibration because this is being stretched at the same time that this is being bent. Right? So will it be a higher or lower frequency than it was before when they weren't coupled? It'll be a little higher, the force constant's higher. Right? Or I can do this. What effect is this spring having on that? It's not having any frequency, because they're going in parallel. It's not stretching this spring. Or I can go like this. And now what? You could get your watch out and count it if you want to, but can you predict whether the frequency is higher or lower now? Will, what do you say? Is it harder or easier to stretch now than it was when I... Yeah, so the frequency will be... Does a stiffer spring vibrate more rapidly or less rapidly? Right, so it's this we know is going to be a higher frequency, and we could time it if we wanted to. We don't have time to time it. Okay, but what I'm going to show you now is this. Suppose I do this. We already did that. But the neat thing is this. What's happening? The vibration's going back and forth. This is obviously a very complicated kind of motion. Right? So this is why the physical chemists were discouraging. They said if you have a molecule that has all these springs and weights connected together, everything's going to be vibrating at the same time in such a complicated way that there'll be no way to understand or interpret what's going on. Maybe it's okay for a fingerprint, but to really identify what they are, forget it. Right? But it turns out that we analyzing this in terms of normal modes can help you see how you really can interpret some things, and that's what we're going to go do next time. I'll do this. There's some slides that go with this that illustrate this. You don't need to do those for the wiki this time. Okay, I'll do this demonstration again at the beginning of the next lecture, and you can do the wikis then. Yeah.
Can I see you tomorrow, maybe at 3 o'clock? Would that be okay?
Yeah, that's okay. Good. All good? Turn this off.